A podcast of the cinema.
Starring you, Alonso Duralde.
And you, Dave White.
You are the,
Oh, here we go.
Film reviews editor at The Wrap. You are a co-host of the Maximum Fun podcast, Who Shot Ya? You are a co-host of the other one that's called Breakfast All Day.
Mm-hmm.
Formerly What the Flick.
Correct.
With Christy Lemire, Matt Ashley, and... occasional drop-ins from Ben Mankiewicz.
With special guest Ben Mankiewicz.
And
you are Dave White. You're a film critic for The Wrap. And this week, you are featured on the Good Christian Fun podcast.
Yes. because God knows why. No.
Interesting choice of phrase.
Here's what happened. Friends, first of all, the episode is finally dropped. No more me going, oh, I'm so excited to be with Good Christian Fun. Like, it's not. It's here. It's here. It's here.
It's a thing in the world.
It's here. Good Christian Fun is a podcast hosted by Kevin Porter and Caroline Ely, and they are Christians currently. And they are... smart and funny and interesting, and they take each episode and they dissect a piece of Christian pop culture. If you don't live in the United States, this is a weird phenomenon that we have in the U.S. much more than other countries. We have a world of evangelical Christianity with lots of pop culture product associated with it.
Its own movies, its own music, its own TV shows.
Yeah. And so they go sort of into their childhoods, really. And they pull up, you know, the VeggieTales and stuff like that.
Yeah. One of the hosts mentioned it being born in 1990. And
right.
I thought, okay, your childhood is my adulthood.
Correct. So what I loved about being invited to be on the show this week is that I got to take them back to the 1980s.
Right.
And one of the stupid things I said on the air was, I'm history dad. And Caroline says, I just found it on Google. I was like, shut up, you. I lived it. And we talked about the Leslie Phillips album from 1987 called The Turning, which is the very last album that she made for the contemporary Christian music world before changing her name back to her childhood nickname of Sam and becoming Sam Phillips, who would then go on to have a 30-year career of critically acclaimed music and film scoring, and not film scoring,
TV scoring.
Television scoring. She was also the mute terrorist in Die Hard 3.
Yes.
And so we talk about that, and we talk about my particular strange experience of being part of the evangelical Christian world in the 1980s.
Right. It's a terrific episode. You should check it out.
Listen, they are terrific. I'm lucky that they're so swift and deft with the editing button to take out the worst parts of me and soften me up a little bit.
Oh, fine. Whatever. Modest mouse.
No, I did. I spent the whole, 5 days after recording thinking, oh, God, I just destroyed their podcast.
You didn't.
And it turned out okay. I listened to it this morning, and I'm happy. And I was a little bit too worried about myself.
Imagine.
You know how it is. You go to a place. You're in a room with people. You're having fun. You're talking. And then when you leave, you think, I'm a jerk. I said all the wrong things, and I was too loud, and I talked over people, and I'm a bulldozer, which is... all of these things are true about me.
I've never had that feeling ever. I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
I was very pleased with the outcome.
I leave a room, you're like, oh, was he here? He was so silent, I didn't hear a thing.
So, we're doing this extra episode today because it's not really an extra episode. It's sort of like the episode you makeup. Should have gotten
yeah.
2 weeks ago when Alonso had laryngitis and he couldn't even talk. In the interim, we've seen so many films
yes.
that I just made a list of what we still have to cover. And there are, not counting An Elephant Sitting Still, which I can't get to.
Yeah.
It closes tomorrow in Los Angeles. It's only playing at 1:30 and 7 p.m. because it's a four-hour movie. I'm just going to have to wait for streaming or DVD. And it was only here for a week. But not counting that, there are 13 other movies we have to talk about.
Beyond what we're talking about today?
No, including what we're talking about today.
Lord.
I had it in my head, though, it'd be fun to talk about An Elephant Sitting Still and Dumbo in the same episode. But that will not happen.
Boo.
That will not happen. The other thing that will not happen is me or you going to the Pet Cemetery screening. Because whose big idea was this?
I don't know.
9 p.m.
9 p.m. Start time.
Start time, 9 p.m., which means start time, 9:15.
Right.
And your response to the publicist was...
What am I, a beatnik? 9 p.m.
At 9:15 p.m. on any given night...
You are halfway to slumber town.
I am already in bed, either reading or... goofing off looking at Twitter.
Your lids are heavy at 9:15.
Yeah.
And I'm quite comfy on the couch.
I have eaten my little piece of weed chocolate to stave off insomnia. You are on the couch watching some infernal Hallmark movie to wind down.
Not necessarily.
Oh, no, necessarily. Almost nightly, you're watching some crap Hallmark movie to wind down from your day. Listen, some people... masturbate. Some people watch Hallmark films. Some people take drugs. It's all the same.
Whatever gets you through the day. Man.
Yes. Whatever helps you ease into sleep. And there are fewer soporific things than a Hallmark film.
It's true.
I saw a silent television commercial for one last night before going to bed. Because you get the volume down for some reason. But I knew the film. I knew what the movie was. And the movie's like, it's spring, time for eggs. Like, and because they do movies all year round now. It's like spring themed. And what's her name? Krampus Cameron Bure was introducing it. And I saw the action of the people and their facial expressions and the mugging and the weirdness, and I thought, first of all, you all need to be pushed off a cliff. Secondly, who would watch this? Oh, wait, my husband.
I don't watch all of them. Like the one you saw the ad for, I am not planning to watch.
Oh, really? You're not? You're
I'm not.
Not planning to. We have no plans to cut the Special Olympics budget.
I'm not
going... But it's going to happen.
I'm not going to watch that.
When you're not looking. Yeah.
How dare you equate me with Betsy DeVos.
I know we just bought this company and we have no plans to liquidate it and fire all of you, but things happen in this world. Yeah, you're going to watch it.
No, I'm not. There are a bunch that I don't watch. You think I watch all of them, but I don't.
Yeah. I can't wait till the Deck the Hallmark guys come to Los Angeles and have to, like, you know, engage with you in person.
You have to. They get to
engage
with you in person. If they come. Apparently that's not entirely a done deal.
Oh, they might not come now?
It's just, I don't know that it's, like, completely set in stone yet, but they might.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a done deal.
No.
All right. I'm talking out of turn.
I guess you are.
All right. We have five films we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about Us.
Mm-hmm.
And Us is going to be the first movie we talk about because we're going to just very briefly discuss it without spoilers. And then at the end of the episode, we're going to do the thing that we have done in the past, where yes. we have two different goodbyes. Goodbye number one will be for all of you who have not yet seen us. After we say goodbye number one, the rest of you can stick around and listen to us talk about the spoilers and why we think what we think about the film. We're also going to talk about Climax, which opened like last month. And you tried and never got yourself out to see it. So I'm just going to take that one and
fine, run and deal
with it. Birds of Passage, which should probably still slowly be making its way around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Transit, which is doing the same thing. And The Aftermath, which just opened. And is it tanking? Or is it Art House doing well in the Art House?
I have not heard a thing
it
about it.
It seems like the kind of movie that would be doing well in the Art House because it's bad.
I haven't seen any headlines saying that it, like, you know, tops indie weekend or anything like that.
So right.
I suspect it's doing averagely.
Oh, we stopped so I could look it up. It's doing fine. It's only on like 24 screens around the country.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Lucky you if you don't have to be near it to see it, because it's not good. all right, let's talk about us. Let's talk about us very briefly. Discuss us. I love us.
I love us. I feel so good about us.
I send you that picture on Valentine's Day of the little plaque that was on sale at Target, and it just said, "I love us."
Ew.
On it. Like, people say these things to each other. Like, couples talk this way to each other, apparently, in real life. They buy little plaques at Target. They put up on... With a straight face, they'll put it up on their walls.
You know who buys that stuff?
I don't know.
The people from that
Nobody
first...
Nobody I know.
The people from that first episode of the Marie Kondo show.
Oh, I know. I know, because their house was covered in that ish.
Yes. Anyway,
we're a family. In this family, we love and forgive and eat and
dream.
Take out the trash and whatever they do. I don't know.
We buy wooden plaques about it. Us is Jordan Peele's sophomore effort, following up his Academy Award winning debut feature, Get Out. It stars Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke, and Nyong'o's character as a child had a somewhat traumatic experience in a carnival funhouse, and when she and her family return to Santa Cruz, to the pier where that event took place, she is full of trepidation and is soon proved to be right. That's all I'll say.
Is that everything we can say?
I think if we're keeping it vague, we'll keep it vague.
I think that's a good way to go, because before I saw this...
Because I didn't watch the trailers.
I did not watch a single trailer on television or in movie theaters. And when you're in a movie theater and that trailer comes on,
mm-hmm.
in order to just keep my fat buttocks in the chair, I had to close my eyes, put my fingers in my ears, and then breathe very loudly through my nose.
Well, I paid money to see Us and had to sit through like six trailers.
Right.
Which I did kind of the same thing for, including the Ma trailer.
I watched the Ma trailer because I don't care.
Okay.
I cared about Us.
Yeah.
Because I love Us.
I care about Us.
In this family, we owe Hasard Balthazar. So, what was I talking about? Where are we going in this?
Trailers.
The trailers. Yeah, I didn't see any trailers for Us. And so, other than images of the scissors and someone wearing a mask and people in red jumpsuits,
right,
all I knew was each time that I was in a movie theater and the trailer would come on, the only thing I actually heard in the trailer was Winston Duke yelling, if you want to get crazy, we can get crazy. But because I did not have a context for that, I didn't know what he was saying,
or
why he was saying that to anyone.
Yeah. I saw somebody. I was at the Schmodown free for all over the weekend, and one of the contestants was cosplaying as Winston Duke's character.
The scene when he's on the bed showing his thighs.
Yes, he was wearing like shorts and a Howard sweatshirt and carrying a baseball bat.
Well,
and I said, in the name of all the women who get given a hard time for cosplaying because their bodies don't match the insane proportions of comic book characters,
yes,
you don't have the legs for this. And he laughed. Because almost no one has the legs for
that. You told this story on the microphone already to me in one of the other podcasts, perhaps one of the Patreon podcasts.
I don't know. Did I?
But it doesn't matter because it's a good story. And if you've heard it twice now, aren't you lucky? But you're still a bad man for body shaming anyone.
He understood.
I know you were kidding. I know you were joking.
For its intent.
And he knew. I know he knew you were joking too. But what a burn! Your thighs are just not there yet.
Yeah.
Go eat some cake, please.
Quit skipping leg day.
Well, it's not even skipping leg day. It's skipping bread day. It's like. You got to work. Listen, the gym is not how you get every beautiful thing that
this
you can
get.
This is true. I don't go to the gym at all. Look at this gorgeous belly. It's voluptuous and round. Who can resist it? Yeah, see?
Body by Pillsbury.
That's right. I love this movie. I love this movie. I want to see it again. Now that I've seen it and I know everything, I want to go back and watch it again. Because when I say I know everything, what I mean is there's still some things I don't know. And that's one of the things I love about it.
Mm.
It does not give away all of its secrets easily. And it does not tell you everything it needs to tell you, everything you want it to tell you easily. It does not lay down an explanation that makes a hell of a lot of sense. It forces you to walk alongside it and accept what it gives you as it gives it to you.
Well, that's one way to put it.
I am happiest in films like this. There is straight up old school art film symbolism going on that isn't adequately explained for the satisfaction of people who want literal, you know, this means this in their life. There is ambiguity. There is explanation about the mysterious elements of the film, but the explanation that's given is delivered in such a cryptic and strange way, and convoluted, that by the end of the explanation, you think, I still don't know what you're talking about.
Well, and see, that's where the movie kind of falls apart for me. I feel like the buildup is very intense. He's very good at dread and making you worry about where things are going to go.
Yes.
But once things have really started going there, and then it's time to explain it all, I found it singularly frustrating because, like, Get Out, you have the one weird thing that you have to buy into, which is, you know, old white people are putting their souls or whatever into, like, young black bodies.
Right.
And you're given that, and then you move on. And once that's established, you don't have to, like, dwell on why it does or doesn't make any sense. You just accept it, and you move on. And then once you move on, you get all the other menu of metaphors that he wants to give you, from the exploitation of black bodies to the things like the picking the cotton out of the chair and like all the all the little subtle, you know, references and in-jokes and metaphors and whatever.
Yes.
This movie gets so bogged down in this grandiose thing that it has to explain and keep explaining.
Yeah.
That it weighs down everything else. And so, yes, it is also rife with symbolism and metaphor and all this other stuff. And I've seen countless articles on Twitter about them. And I read these articles and I go, well, yes, that's there. That is there. He is saying that. That is all there. But none of that makes this movie any more satisfying to me. I don't dislike it. I think it's got a lot going on. And Lupita Nyong'o's performance is great.
She's really wonderful
here. Yeah.
As everything she has to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I really think that this script could have used another pass or two. And I worry that, and we see this happen all the time, from Tarantino to Shyamalan to whoever else, like, you knock it out of the park early, and suddenly nobody can say no to you, and nobody can produce you, and nobody can hold that thought.
We had a doorbell.
We did.
And now we have a silent guest who's chilling while we record.
Here for observation. Anyway, so I worry about, and this happens in every medium. It's not just film. You see it in, novels and, television, whatever else. Like, yes, it's great when you are, like, immediately successful, but at the same time, it's like, then who's going to tell you no,
I'm not with you necessarily yet.
Okay.
Give me
another
couple movies.
I'm not saying he's gone down the stony end.
He has at all. No. I just am appreciative of that this film is so much weirder than Get Out. And
it does not lack for ambition.
I like that he's really going for what he wants to do.
Okay.
And if it doesn't all gel together, I do not care. I want it to exist as it exists, and we will explain why
in the spoiler segment.
At the end of the show, spoiler.
I looked it up. Yeah. Its cinema score was a B.
Really?
Yeah.
Which is. I assumed it might be much lower.
I thought it might be worse too, because I know a lot of audiences have been like, so
I think. If you didn't like it, I'm not saying that you're a literal-minded simpleton. Or am I? No,
you best not.
I'm sure there is an element of the audience that didn't like it. Who are?
Some non-dumb people on my Facebook feed.
Right, no. There are plenty of smart people who didn't like it at all. And then there's you, who I think is very smarty-pants-ish. And you liked it-ish.
Well, yeah. It do check out the Who Shot Ya episode about this movie, because we were all sort of dancing around the topic until somebody finally came out and admitted what they felt about it, and then everybody else sort of chimed in.
Yeah, ultimately, movies like this become lightning rods for conversation and debate and argument, and I'm never interested in that. Because once I've had a conversation with you about a movie, I don't care about having it with anyone else.
Oh.
No, that was not a declaration of love. That was me expressing
fed up with.
Yeah, I don't, I'm, it exhausts me.
I hear you.
Arguing about movies exhausts me.
No, for sure.
And every once in a while, people will come at me on Twitter or Facebook and be like, why did you like blah, blah, blah? And I'll be like, well, perhaps you could go read the review I wrote or listen to this podcast and you'll understand it all. But if you have finer details of questions to ask me after you do those things, then we might have a 4-minute conversation about it.
Maybe.
But very much like the Dixie Chicks, I ain't got time to go round and round.
I know. I mean, I think the older you get, the more you realize these arguments are fruitless, because it's not like you're going to win anybody over to your side with your crystal logic. It's just like, it either, this is how it played for you.
And young male film internet, particularly young male film Twitter, is an atmosphere predicated on winning.
True.
And I could be baking something. Honestly, I could be having a nap.
You're right.
Both of those things are way better.
All right, let's move on then.
Us is great. Go see it.
Us is fine, but you should see it.
Let's talk about Climax.
Yes, tell me, because I've seen only one Gaspar Noé film, and I thought I maybe wanted to see this one.
Which one did you see?
The sex one.
Love.
Yes. Love, if that's what you call it. Yes, I saw Love. And I thought I wanted to see Climax based on the original trailers, and then I started reading things about it. I was like, maybe I don't.
I want you to see the first 45, 50 minutes.
Okay. The step-up part?
Yeah. Yes. That's what it is. That's the step-up part.
Was it Ingu who wrote the piece delineating all the times when you can walk out of Climax?
That was Ingu. You know that I worship at the throne of the great Kang.
Yes.
The great and mighty Kang.
Kang the Conqueror.
But she and I do not see the same
yes.
way on this movie.
Oh, I disagree with her early enough.
That's fine. Yes.
It's part of the appeal.
This is a new movie from Gaspar Noé. He made I Stand Alone. He made Irreversible. He made Enter the Void, Love. Am I missing another one?
I think that might be it for features.
All right. This film is set in 1996. It is about a group of dancers who are in an isolated warehouse far outside of the city. Now, this physically...
Are they performing Volk?
This physically puts them... No, they are not. This physically puts them outside of the ability that we have in the contemporary world of being reachable.
I was going to say, is this 1996 just so that no one has a cell phone?
Well, I don't know. The filmmaker himself has been maddeningly insistent that everything you want to see is everything you want to know is in the film.
Huh.
But I think otherwise. For the first 45 to 50 minutes of this film, they dance. And oh, what astonishing dancing it is. Set to a soundtrack that is thrilling. It's all, you know, music of the time and music from earlier times. So like Supernature and, you know, these amazing dance tracks that kind of all sound like Giorgio Moroder.
I was going to say, is this how French are we talking here?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wonderful music, staggering dancing. And then the credits roll. And then the movie starts. Now, but before the dancing, you see about 5 or 10 minutes of videotaped interviews with the dancers. And they are all playing on a TV screen, a 1996 small, crappy TV screen. Next to the TV screen is a stack of VHS tapes, and on the other side is a stack of books.
Oh, God, this is how Us starts.
And, yeah, kind of. The stack of VHS tapes next to the movie, next to the video, is stuff like Eraserhead and Suspiria and Possession and Solo and every extreme sort of cult cinema favorite. So he's telling you something before he starts telling you things.
Just like in Us.
Then comes the dancing, and then come the credits, and then comes the movie. Mm. Here's what happens. Someone has dosed the punch at their little dance gathering with some extremely powerful LSD. And the trips are bad.
Mm.
remember when I watched Enter the Void here at the house? And you were in the office.
Yes.
And you could hear the cacophony.
The opening credits.
Of agony and noise and screaming and car crashes and, you know, all that stuff. That's the movie that you see after the dance.
Enter the Void, yeah. That's a movie that freaked me out and I was in another room.
Mr. Noe loves a freak out.
Okay.
And he loves to push his characters into freak outs.
Mm-hmm.
Some really terrible things happen to the people in this film. Almost all of it self-inflicted because they're all on drugs. It's not a whodunit necessarily, although someone in the room is responsible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a child involved.
No.
Yeah. And by the end of the movie, you begin to wonder why this setting, why these people, what France is this? Are we seeing a political film? And to me, very much like Nocturama from a couple years ago, my answer is yes, we're seeing a political film. We're seeing...
Even if Noe says otherwise.
We're seeing a dance party that is being destroyed. And very much like the film that we're about to talk about, Transit, I think that, you know, if you're going to talk about music in France in the 90s, you cannot help but talk about the dominance of, or the increasing influence, not necessarily maybe, but not necessarily the dominance, but the increasing influence of electronic music and dance music in the culture. And what those... what that meant as in terms of like the possibilities for young, cool, forward-looking France. What was that going to be? Well, now you see that France is sort of having the same problem that England is having and the same problem that we're having. Everything feels to be like it's falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
Everything feels to be like the promise of that earlier optimism, you know, boundaries breaking down and
the Cold War being
over. a more culturally diverse world happening. It feels like someone's trying to destroy it. Because someone is trying to destroy it. The specter of fascism is creeping across Europe and the United States right now. There are no moments in this film that signpoint you toward this idea. It's the feeling you get, you know. Because you don't just make a movie about a drug freak out for the sake of making a movie about a drug freak out. You're making a movie about something.
Right.
What is that something? Well, I've decided that I know what that something is. Am I right? Who knows? Would you like to debate me? No.
Wasn't the First Lady of France a pop star in the 90s?
I cannot remember.
Sarkozy's wife?
I do not know the answer.
What is her name?
I also don't know the answer to that.
Do you know? Okay, no, all right. Anyway, you're yelling at your speaker. You know,
shaking head. No, silent guest. That's a problem. I have decided that that is the film I have seen.
Okay, fair enough.
And I like Gaspar Noé because
Carla Bruni,
because he. Sure, very much like Quentin Tarantino, he's taking things from other filmmakers.
Yeah.
But you always know when you're watching one of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If it's not 3D erections ejaculating on you, like in Love.
Yes.
That
wasn't just a,
no,
a
was
what
just,
if.
Was just, yeah, that wasn't a hypothetical. That really happens in the movie Love. You know, his films are not necessarily enjoyable all the time. They can be punishing, irreversible. Should come with every content warning that can come with a film.
I have still not. I can't.
But he's out there in his own little lane, making the kind of movies he wants to make. And they have meaning. They aren't just visual trips.
Right.
Frankly, this feels to me more pointed than Enter the Void. Although Enter the Void is the most sort of overwhelmingly stylish and trippy movie.
Well, which is also about a drug trip in a way, right?
It's about the aftermath of an overdose.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ghost. The guy's ghost sort of floats over, you know, everywhere. I really enjoyed this. Obviously, the second half is painful as everyone sort of descends into madness and chaos, and eventually some of them their deaths. But, ooh, that first 45 minutes, that's some dancing. That's dancing.
Just imagining like Gene Kelly talking about over in France, Gaspar Noé is doing amazing things.
It is still playing in Los Angeles, which means that it's probably still moving its way around the country in other smaller markets.
Probably so, yes.
So I guess we're not too late
with
it. If you don't watch the entire thing, I'll understand that, but boy, that first 50 minutes. Do they give choreography Oscars? Because they should.
They do not.
Well, stupid. They should. It's amazing. It's okay. Really, the first sequence is really something to behold.
Well, all right then.
Let's talk about The Aftermath.
Speaking of Nazi creep.
As I said to Madeline Brand on KCRW a couple weeks ago when this film opened, after World War II...
I'm sorry you dropped this name. I just wanted to pick it up for you.
It's not a name drop if she's someone that we work with every single month.
Yeah, please, you said that in a very... hey, everybody, way.
Well, you know what? I've been a film critic for low 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I go on KCRW in Santa Monica once a month to talk to the lovely Madeline Brand.
Yes,
you do. As
do
you.
That's also true.
And we were asked to do that.
Also true.
So, anybody who doesn't like it and thinks that I'm name-dropping can just have a seat over to the side there.
Okay, Aftermath. You were saying to Ms. Brand.
After World War II in Europe, everybody was really horny. And that's what this movie's about.
Pretty much.
Why don't you explain what happened?
Okay. Keira Knightley is traveling to Hamburg. It's months after the end of World War II. Her husband,
like
Jason...
6 months or so.
5 months, I think it says in the crawl.
Coming on Christmas.
Exactly. Her husband, Jason Clark, is a British officer, and he is overseeing the, you know, post-war reconstruction. The two of them have been billeted in a beautiful house owned by German architect.
A manse.
Yes. The manor.
Yeah.
Owned by German architect, played by Alexander Skarsgård.
The sweaters he wears.
Not a single moth
hole. You've seen Alexander Skarsgård and you know he's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put him in these sweaters.
And then you see him tweety.
Then you see him in these sweaters and you're like, oh my God. Like, how is it possible that you can look even better wearing clothes?
So he and his daughter are about to be sort of shipped off to a kind of a relocation camp. And Jason Clark's like, no, please. It's a huge house. Go live in the attic.
The kid deserves it. She's a brat.
Yeah, the kid's a pain in the ass. She winds up getting involved with... some young holdout Nazis,
Hitler youth.
Yeah, basically. And, you know, Jason Clark is trying to like sort of keep things copacetic, and so he's ignoring Keira Knightley. And they've had problems anyway because of tragedy in their past that they haven't really dealt with or talked about.
The film will let you know this in the first 5 minutes when she opens up a locket. And you see a young child in a photo with them. There ain't no child with them.
Yep.
So that kid died somehow.
Do that math.
Yeah.
So anyway, so Sears, of course, she's driven into the arms of Alexander Skarsgård. And who can blame her? Yeah. This is one of those movies where they either should have, like, full on dived into the deep end of Soap Town.
They do.
No, I think they should have just, like, that's all they needed to do.
Right.
But they also want to make it about...
there's some steamy action in this movie.
They're also trying to be sort of, like, addressing the sort of historical moment and, like, you know, was Skarsgård's character a Nazi or was he one of the good Germans?
Well, look how handsome he is. You know he was one of the good ones.
It's, yeah, it just, it doesn't ever really take off dramatically.
It takes off soapishly, it takes off historically, it takes off sexually, it takes off stupidly. It wraps all of these things up in one big dumb ball and throws it at you and says, ta-da!
Movie!
Look at these outfits. Look at this furniture. Look at how period impeccable the details are.
Yeah.
Oh, and they are.
Oh, well, sure, yeah.
Everything looks really good.
But I think even if you are one of those people who goes to a movie for the handbags, I don't know if this one is going to have quite enough to...
I'm going to give it the handbag review just for a moment.
If she has a couple of knockout gowns.
If that's all you care about, if all you care about is houses, furniture, cars, hair clips,
tea sets,
rugs, teacups, the texture of a woman's jacket. Silent guest is going to be able to know the difference between what was made for the film and what is actually vintage.
Yes. Is there enough of that stuff?
Absolutely satisfying on that level.
Okay. Because, like,
also, it's in winter, so that's like...
Well, that's... Yes.
Winter is the best
coats.
Europe... Coats. Yeah. And so...
Because, like, I will look at a movie that is otherwise wildly mediocre, like Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day.
Such
and
as.
Totally get that, yes, if you're there on the handbag tip, you know, you're going to be in hog heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure this movie...
What was that dumb movie last year about the books? Was it called The Bookshop? The Book...
Oh, the Bookshop, the Bookstore, or something. Yeah, that was terrible.
What a rotten movie that was. And you know what? I'd watch it again. It is so...
For the raincoats?
It is so lushly detailed and so weirdly fake. Everything about it is wrong, but also right. That's kind of what this movie's like, too. It's much more drab and muted because, you know, 6 months after World War II in Hamburg. And
yeah, it's like all the streets are mud, basically, and the buildings are... You know, they're still digging corpses
out of the
rubble.
There are enough scenes in the mansion.
And
it's
a little... At the tea restaurant where they are going to.
The hats on the ladies. And people are doing it in this movie. Mm. It's bad. Take your mom. You know moms like those tasteful European art house sex movies.
Yeah. Keira Knightley gets busy.
Yeah.
For sure.
And no one had a no nudity clause in their contract either. Or else those were body doubles because there was, you know, good loving.
That reminds me, have we talked about Gloria Bell yet?
Not yet. That's on my list.
It's on your list, okay.
We got to get down to that.
Okay.
You've seen it.
I have.
I have to catch up on it.
Okay.
But I will.
Okay.
It's playing a lot closer than an elephant standing still or sitting still. And it's...
Not 4 hours
long. And it's not 4 hours long. I can go to the Grove and see Gloria Bell.
Yeah.
Get myself a little...
Pretzel dog?
That or some macaron from La Durée.
There you go.
Yeah. One or the other.
You contain multitudes.
Birds of Passage.
Yes. Didn't see it. Tell me.
Birds of Passage is the latest film from the directors of Embrace of the Serpent, Ciro Guerra and Cristina Gallego.
Right.
It is such a strange movie. Briefly, the plot is a family of indigenous people in Colombia from the Wayuu people, and I'm saying that wrong, I'm sure. A matriarchal society. They speak something other than, you know, Spanish.
Right.
And the film is in, like, both.
Mm.
Yeah. It's the kind of super enclosed world where, you know, the women who run things, you know, have visions, and everyone has to listen to them have their visions. Mm. And they, you know, there's just lots of ceremonies and rituals and stuff like that. And then they sell weed to some Peace Corps workers. And the Peace Corps workers, it's the early 1960s.
Okay.
The Peace Corps workers are like, oh, hey, we could sell this back in the United States and you could get it to us and you could make some money. Do you care about that? And, you know, a young man of the clan says, yeah, I need to prove myself. That's sort of like to be a worthy, you know, man in my culture.
Mm.
So he becomes a drug dealer, a drug supplier.
Right.
And then a drug lord.
Ah.
I don't want to say it is simply a crime family saga, because that would be sort of reductive. I mean, it is that. But it's shot and approached with an almost like ethnographic documentary style of filmmaking.
Right.
And it's much more distant than the typical drug crime family saga, because you know how these movies go. You've seen them before.
Sure, but this is the end of the production chain you don't ever get.
Right. Someone starts selling drugs. Someone makes money selling drugs. Suddenly, more money and more money and more money, and
somebody else wants to kill them to get
the problems because people want to kill you, and you butt up against other families that are in the same crime.
Mm-hmm.
But in let's say an American made film like that, or a terrifically awful movie like City of God. That's right. City of God sucks. Come at me. Will we have an argument and a discussion about it? We will not. Those films are very interested in the rush and excitement and the ecstasy.
Sure, the rise and fall.
Of money. And, oh my God, we're so rich now.
Right.
I'm buying a Panther. Like, it's, you know, everybody wants to tell you the story the way that Goodfellas and Scarface...
Let's cover the bed in $100 bills and roll around on it.
Right. This movie delivers all the tension and all the absurdity of that with a sort of observational distance. So you never get that ecstatic, we're so rich now moment. All you see suddenly is a huge modernist house in the middle of a cracked desert plain with nothing else around it. No gates, no nothing. People can drive right up to the door. Like, somewhere along the way, someone said, oh, I guess we have to build a giant house for ourselves. But they hadn't seen Scarface because it's 1969, 1970. And so they didn't know how to do it yet.
Right.
They were so sealed off from the outside world that they weren't.
And they never assumed they had to protect themselves.
The film says it's based on a true-ish story.
Uh-huh.
I've read some articles since then that are saying, well, but this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong. So, I mean, there's a lot of artistic license going on.
What? In a fiction film?
Yeah. There are not especially heavy messages going on about colonialism, although that's what the film is entirely about.
Sure.
It's just a fascinating story of how tradition gets trampled, and it happens bit by bit, and it happens willingly with the help of the people who keep talking about how much they love the traditions that they revere and that keep them honorable. Anyway, I liked it quite a bit. It's not emotionally moving necessarily to me. It's more sort of I'm watching this other world.
Right.
You know.
I need to go back and see.
One that I can never understand fully because I live in the northern half of the world. And, right. You know.
I need to go back and see Embrace of the Serpent, which I heard was really good.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have any interest in catching up on this, but I did have someone on Instagram ask if we, and I think you, were going to review Lords of Chaos.
It was in Los Angeles for 1 week on an abbreviated schedule at 10 o'clock at night.
Bill.
At the one theater in town that was showing it.
Was it day and date? Like, is it streaming?
I believe it is. I believe it's available to be streamed. I just haven't sit myself down in a metal mood to watch it yet. But I'm going to.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I read the book.
Oh, right.
It's based on the book Lords of Chaos.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about one of my favorite kinds of music. And it's about murders. So, you know, what's not to love about that? Anyway, Birds of Passage. I recommend.
Okay.
It's good. Again, it didn't leave me feeling some kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
One of those movies you walk out of and you admire the filmmaking and that you're glad you've seen it. You're just not... you're not carrying it in your heart, you know. Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah. Worth your time.
Okay.
Finally, Transit.
Hmm.
This is a strange film. It's from Christian Petzold. He made Phoenix.
Yes.
Which I liked quite a bit.
Right.
It's based on a novel set in the beginning of World War II.
Right.
However, the film takes place in 2018, 2019, whatever.
I mean, a 2019 without computers or phones, but...
No, there's phones.
Are there?
Yeah.
But, I mean, are there, like, smartphones?
I think I saw them in the film, yeah.
Okay. But, yeah, essentially, they have pretty much just plopped it into the modern day without changing... Most of I imagine what was in the book, and it scans.
And it fits fairly well. So there's a man named George. He's on the run from Paris to Marseille.
Because they actually say the Nazis are coming in, right?
Do they use
the word? Or is it the Germans? It's the Germans.
They just say the Germans. They don't say the Nazis.
You're right. The Germans are coming in.
That's a port city. And the only way you can get there is to prove that you have papers to get out of the port city and go to someplace else, to flee.
It's like in Casablanca, where they're all trying to get letters of transit.
Yes. Along the way, he meets people.
He assumes someone else's identity.
That is why he has his letter of transit. Yes. Because he has taken the identity of a dead man. He meets the dead man's wife. He also meets some refugees from another country. And what should be an easy transition for him out of the country so that he can escape the Germans, whatever they mean, becomes very complicated. Because he lingers and he takes time with all of these people around him. And that puts him in danger. What I love about this movie is its insistence on no one seeming to take the situation as seriously as they should. Because no one talks about World War II in the movie.
Right.
No one says, why is fascism happening again? Why are we all having to flee the country? No one says this is just like World War II. It's as though World War II didn't happen. Even though the source material is set then.
Mm.
That's the thing I love the most about it, is that it's set in a world right now that is this close to becoming real again.
No, and that's I think is the best idea the movie has.
Yeah. That creeping, vague, oh, it'll probably be okay, right?
Yeah.
It's not really going to be as bad as people are worrying it's going to be about.
Right.
Meanwhile, it's as bad.
Yes.
They're coming to get you. They're going to put you in a camp.
That is what I liked about the film. What I didn't like about the film is that it is the classic Roger Ebert, the 5-minute conversation no one is having. Namely, he keeps not telling the dead writer's wife that he is using the dead writer's passport and that he has a letter of transit to get the two of them out of the country.
Yes.
And there's never, I don't think, a good reason for him not to tell her this, except that he is trying to figure out if she's really fallen back in love with the writer because they've been estranged, or if it's just that she wants to get out of the country and knows that she can only do it with him. And for some reason, this is so important to him that he can't just tell her what's going on. And the not telling her what's going on adds 45 minutes to the movie. And it drove me up the wall.
It intentionally, I believe, sort of chases its own tail.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the emotional quality of that is to make you frustrated and afraid. Like, why is no one simply going from point A to B to C and getting the F out?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we lingering? Why are we not talking? Why are we not behaving the way you should in an emergency?
I don't think it's his reticence to have that discussion is conveyed in a way that implies that he's not taking the situation seriously. Because we've seen him, like, he's watched people get shot in the street.
Right.
He's tried to help this guy get down there and watch him die in the process. Like,
he,
I think, fully gets the ramifications of the situation, which makes his inactivity just frustrating. and not dramatically explained. You know, and I think if they had sort of given more of an understanding of where he's coming from and why he's handling matters the way he is, fine. It's not everything has to be go, go, go all the time, but it's sort of like, give me a reason for this apart from a screenwriter's contrivance, you know?
I believe that had the story worked out in a way that was narratively satisfying the way you're talking about, it would feel less frightening because we would have a resolution that allowed us to walk out of the film and think, there's always a way out of this.
Now, and again, I get what you're saying. And yes, this is a movie that should make you feel tense and on edge.
Because this is a really, really sort of crystal clear mirror of the world right now.
No, absolutely. And again, that's I think the movie's best idea. But I think there's a way that you could convey all that stuff and make people leave the theater thinking like, this is not an easily resolvable situation in a way that makes narrative sense.
Mm.
Like you could provide actual obstacles.
Perhaps we differ.
Perhaps we do.
It stars an actor named Franz Rogowski.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know much about him.
He looks like he would be playing like
he was in
young,
Victoria.
He looks like if what's his face made a movie of his own life.
okay, who's what's his face?
The Brown Bunny guy, Vincent Gallo. If Vincent Gallo was casting like young Vincent Gallo,
young handsome Vincent Gallo,
he would cast.
Okay, I guess I see what you're talking about there. You know, he might not take kindly to being compared to Vincent Gallo. Paula Beer, who I've seen before.
She was in François Ozon's France. I don't know if you saw that. But
I didn't.
Okay. I was not a huge fan of it.
Yeah. Anyway, I've seen her in something else. I don't know. Again, German film, Christian Petzold. I recommend this. I'm way more into this than you are, I understand. If you saw Phoenix and you liked Phoenix, I think this is it's a less narratively concise film than Phoenix, but I think I like it more.
Really?
Yeah.
More than Phoenix?
Yeah.
Because you were a big fan of Phoenix.
I liked Phoenix a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, That's it. Okay, that's five movies. We have finished five movies. Talking about five movies.
Do you have a DVD pick?
I do not, because we've been flying by the seat of our pants all day with this. We haven't talked about it.
Well, I have a streaming pick, and you can make this yours as well.
Okay, sure. Mine too. Whatever it is, it's also my pick.
On Amazon Prime right now, you can watch Stephen Kayak's beautiful documentary, Scott Walker, 30th Century Man.
Yes.
We lost Scott Walker this week.
Yes.
As Dave pointed out on our Patreon page, for the people who get our daily LKRX recommendations, Scott Walker did the exact opposite thing that pop singers do as they get older, which is that he got weirder.
Yeah.
And this documentary sort of tracks him from the Walker Brothers through his legendary four solo albums and then into like more sort of strange and experimental stuff. It's a really terrific film.
He did the film score for Leo's character's Pola X, which is going to screen here in Los Angeles upcoming in the next month or two. Sandy Tan, our lovely friend, mm-hmm. and the director of the documentary Shirkers, that's yes. on Netflix, that everyone should watch. She is hosting screenings at the, I think it's the Hammer.
I will not be attending.
She's hosting screenings of Pola X and like three other movies, and I'm blanking now what the other ones are. But yeah. Oh, I'm going back to Pola X.
I remember. I love that movie. There's some of the other ones sounded interesting, but yeah, I'm never sitting through Pola X. Fool me once, Dave Weiss. Anyway, Scott Walker.
One of my fondest memories of our marriage is dragging you to the Egyptian to see Pola X and feeling you bristle and chafe during the entire running time. And when we walked out of
particularly during the Scott Walker sequences, actually.
When we walked out of it at the end, you said, I don't like you. You take me to terrible movies. I am angry. I'm hungry. And I thought to myself, that's the man for me. And glad I put a ring on that.
I love Holy Motors, but Jesus Christ, never again with the Pola X. Anyway, Amazon Prime, Scott Walker, 30th Century Man. It's great. Stephen Kayak's a very talented filmmaker, and you should see it. We have letters. Or do you want to... Oh, actually, before we do letters, Patreon. We've mentioned a couple times.
Right.
We have a Patreon page, patreon.com/linoleumknife. So much extra stuff for people who want extra stuff.
Go there, and it is all very self-explanatory. There's a video of us talking about it. You can, all the levels,
you
all
can
the
get
things,
up to three extra shows from us every week. Yeah. Google Hangout opportunities as we watch films together. Cool stuff that we'll send you so that we can then talk about it in yet another Google Hangout.
Yeah.
Personalized podcast made for you and you alone. All kinds of cool stuff. Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Okay, letters really fast so that we can get you out of here.
Yes, please.
This is from Wilson. It might be too late to put this in the next podcast, but since you've recommended it so many times, you might want to tell your listeners that in the Bay Area, that Two for the Road is playing at the Castro Theater in San Francisco this Saturday night, March 30th.
Oh, I would love to see that movie, The Castro.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be so nice.
That's such a nice theater.
Yeah.
It's a cool old place to see a movie.
Anyway, pay tribute to the late, great Stanley Donen and see one of our favorite films of all time. Yeah, go see it at The Castro. And then, you know, if you aren't a Patreon member, you can a la carte buy our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode about the film.
Yeah.
Where we do a commentary track, basically.
Okay, so this is a long one, and it might be all we have time for, but I'm going to read it.
Okay.
This is from Sophie.
Yes.
Heard from many times. Mm-hmm. And so she says, I watched 5 Feet Apart. You talked about 5 Feet Apart last week.
Yes.
Well, not last week, about a few days ago when we did the last episode.
And I said I wanted to hear from people who had a more firsthand experience about it. And
well, here we go.
Sophie took up the call.
Yep. She says, I watched 5 Feet Apart and became incandescent with rage. I need to put my glasses on for this one.
Yes.
It's longer. I have a chronic degenerative bone disease. And as a kid, I went to summer camps every year for kids with disabilities. a lot of the other kids had cystic fibrosis or severe muscular dystrophy and therefore had life expectancies in their 20s and 30s. Here's the thing. People with disabilities in general, but especially kids and teens with disabilities, are so starved of representation in the media that we will flock to anything that even gets close to portraying our experiences. And I hate that kids with CF and other chronic conditions will go see this movie, and once again they will see a story made by and for able-bodied people, one that feels tailor-made to make able-bodied audience members cry as the lives of young people with CF are used as tragedy porn. I'm lucky in that my life expectancy is basically normal, although my physical function will likely decrease throughout my life. But I've had a lot of friends die, especially in recent years, as their illnesses caught up with them. I think it's hard for normal folks, normal in this letter is in the word, is in quotes, I think it's hard for normal folks to understand that nobody thinks of their own life as a tragedy. Their teen crushes were just that, teenage crushes. It didn't become Romeo and Juliet just because one or both parties had a life-limiting condition. Nobody thinks of their own life as a tragedy. And films like this one are frustrating because even though they try and humanize the protagonists, and even though they get some things right, finding loopholes and the instructions that you've been given by your doctor is very much a vital part of the teen crip experience. Their premise remains one of tragedy. It's pity porn. And here's the other thing. Most of the American teens and 20-somethings with CF I know died because they couldn't afford transplant costs or because their funding for personal care was slashed and they didn't have the money for a support person to get them to help them clean out the mucus from their lungs and they got pneumonia, or because they had to ration their inhalers and oxygen supplies because their insurance only covered so much each month. They didn't die because they had cystic fibrosis. They were murdered by a system that puts profit over people. Any film that claims to meaningfully contend with disability or chronic illness in the United States and doesn't show how people are fighting for their lives, not against their illnesses, but against the government and insurance agencies, will always come up wanting. Although the filmmakers consulted with people with cystic fibrosis and they got many details right, it's important to note that there were no disabled people in the writer's room. I'm tired of films made about disabled people that don't involve actual disabled people at any meaningful level. Consulting is not enough. I doubt Crazy Rich Asians would have been very good if it was an all-white cast and production team, but they'd hired a single person from Singapore to consult after the fact. If the film donated a portion of its profits to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, or if they had hired disabled actors, or if they had been more explicitly political, I would feel differently. As it is, F this movie. Also, here's a pretty good article about the decidedly mixed response this film has gotten from the CF community. It's on Refinery 29. So can we post this on the...
Put it on the Facebook page.
On the Linoleum Knife Facebook page, this article?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, thank you for that, Sophie.
Thank
I appreciate
you for
your
that,
feedback.
Sophie. I love letters like this.
Yes.
Very, very...
We always like an insider perspective.
Yep.
All right.
And we're done.
So we're gearing up to goodbye number one. Just going to say real quick, subscribe to the show for free on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review there. We'll read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and thelounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, whatnot. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. He's at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And you can drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. And here's where we stop before giving us spoilers. So if you don't want to hear them...
Goodbye, number one. And now... Us. Spoilered. What you got?
Okay. So, we open in 1986, Santa Cruz.
Hands Across America.
Hands Across America TV commercial. She goes to the pier with her parents who are arguing and not paying enough attention to her. Little girl wanders off, goes to this hall of mirrors, and encounters... what appears to be a mirror image, but is actually someone who looks exactly like her.
Yeah.
She's traumatized by the event, doesn't talk for months.
Years later, she's an adult. She's now Lupita Nyong'o. She's on vacation with her family. They are going to a summer home that they own.
It's her house.
And they have a boat and everything. So they got, you know.
They talk about it being her house from childhood.
They got some money.
Yeah.
So, and they get into the summer house and four identical strangers.
Well, at first she tells the husband.
Yeah.
She goes, look, this thing happened to me as I was a kid and it, you know, creaked me out and there was this other girl there and yada, yada. And then suddenly there is a family of four standing in their driveway.
All wearing red jumpsuits.
All wearing red jumpsuits, holding hands, looking like the family sticker on the back of their car. You know, people have those little stick figures with the mommy, daddy, son, and daughter.
And it's them.
And it's them.
Their identical doppelgangers.
Yes.
Yeah, which is redundant.
Yes. So each family member has to sort of fight off their sort of mirror image person who's trying to kill them. And Lupita's delivers this long monologue about how there was this cloning program and they all live in these tunnels underneath. I know, I can't even do, if I were at full voice, I could try to impersonate.
I want to know who worked with her.
It's apparently
she's a vocal coach.
It is. She's apparently doing, there's some kind of affliction that makes you talk in that way. Like that's what she's doing with her voice.
Right. But how did she do it without destroying her voice?
That I don't know.
Because when she talks as that person,
yeah,
all I could feel was strain and agony. And not just narratively and character-based. I mean, like, vocally.
Right. So you come to find out that, you know, Lupita's shadow self sort of inspired this revolution among all these clones that live in these underground tunnels who have been feeding on rabbits for whatever reason.
Live raw rabbits.
And, you know, has
shipped in from the favorite.
Yeah, basically. And because I, you know, she's got this t-shirt with Hands Across America on it. She puts everybody in these red jumpsuits because the Hands Across America logo was these like red stick figures holding hands.
Right.
So everybody gets a red jumpsuit. Everybody gets scissors, which I'm already thinking, who made them? Where did they get, as Dre put it, where did they get 325 million red jumpsuits and golden shears?
I haven't listened to y'all's episode yet. About
no, it airs. It drops Friday.
It drops Friday. Did April talk about the Norwegian folklore aspects of this?
She did.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, and there
because
are
that's relevant.
There are apparently a lot of folklores around the world that involve like that underground. There's a person that's exactly like you who's trying to usurp your place and how you fend them off and blah blah blah. So now all the shadow people are coming up from the underground and murdering their, you know, human people who've been oppressing them. Right. And so, okay, again, this is a story that is rife with metaphor. It's about, you know, how we treat the homeless. It's about privilege. It's about, you know, the shadow self and the doppelganger and all that kind of stuff. And yes, I get all that, but it's like, it's such a convoluted backstory that like yes, it shouldn't matter, we should just move past it, but like it's so complicated and so muddled that I couldn't stop thinking about just the logistics of it
trying all. To figure out how it all was supposed to make sense.
Yes, somebody was
that
saying
that did not bother me at all.
Okay.
And I a lifetime of, you know, oblique, narratively, you know, strange art house film has perhaps made me more accepting of that kind of thing. Not that that's a better way of life, but it's my way of life. And so I walk out of this movie and I turn to friend Brian and I said, I really like that movie. Also, the part of me inside that is reflective of national historical trauma also liked that movie. And the other part of me that carries death around inside him also liked that movie.
Did you predict the final switcheroo?
No, I didn't. But
I didn't either, but other people have told me I have.
That final switcheroo, here's the first thing I did think. It's the last shot of the Thriller video.
Oh, funny. Okay, because her dad wins her a Thriller t-shirt.
T-shirts are reflective of several things in the film. Like, she's got the Thriller t-shirt on at the beginning. The little boy has a Jaws t-shirt on at the beginning. And then there's a scene at the beach, which I swear is shot for shot Roy Scheider freaking out.
Right.
By looking at too many things that are crowding his vision and making him afraid. And then Lupita Nyong'o is doing exactly the same thing, and it's shot the same way. And when it happened, I thought, ooh, Jaws.
The final switcheroo is that Lupita's shadow self switched places with her.
As a child,
which is why she didn't speak for a couple of months.
And then she learned how to be.
And then took over her life while real Lupita basically like became an underground, literally underground revolutionary.
Yeah. The weirder he gets, if he keeps getting weirder, Paul Thomas Anderson is thanked in the credits of this film. Hmm. And I remember, as I watched that credit thank go past me, I made a wish. And my wish was Jordan Peele, get weirder and weirder and weirder.
But okay.
I would love it if you
I want to be that. Clear here. Yeah. My objection here isn't that I'm like so thuddingly prosaic.
No, I don't say that's what you are.
I know, but I just want to...
I don't believe that's what you are.
I want to be clear. It's not that I have to be spoon-fed. It's not like everything has to make some sort of narrative sense.
Right.
But it's like, either don't tell me anything and plunge me into some weirdness, or like back it up if you're going to start getting into the details. But if you're going to give me a little detail and then walk away, I'm like, wait, stop. Who's feeding the rabbits? Like, why do all the underground people have the same outfits that the overground people do, but dirty?
Yeah.
How do the underground people manage to create children with each other to then match if the cloning experiment is over? All that kind of stuff. I'm like, stop! What? That was my problem.
I didn't have those problems.
Okay.
Again, I don't know why. You and I are different people.
Again, we are.
We look at things differently.
That's why we do this show.
Yeah.
No, and again, I so many articles that I've read that talk about all it's about this, and this is why, you know, Jeremiah 11:11 is in it, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's all, I read all of it, and I think, yes, that's in this movie. It is there to be interpreted and read and whatever. But on a straight up, you're telling me a story about a thing, I just found it real choppy once we get to the explanations.
My shadow self grooved right along to it.
Great. So,
there you go.
Is that it?
That's it for me.
Okay. So anyway, that's our thought on us. That's us's thought on us.
Would you like to say goodbye again?
Yes, but I think...
Would you like to be the person who says goodbye?
No, it should be you.
It should be me.
I do it on other shows. You want to hear me say goodbye, go join our Patreon.
That is true. You do say goodbye on, I guess, all the other shows, right? Yeah. All the Patreon shows. Yeah. You're the goodbyer.
Because you are.
You're the goodbye girl.
This is your big moment of goodbying.
Okay. Goodbye.